Hey, good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about security by talking about an approach that's kind of an alternative to access controllers. This we called capabilities, and this is the idea that rather than accessing something via some global name and then having to check some information on the side about whether we were allowed to access it, or presumably the kernel or something else would do that checking, that the way we tell the kernel or something else what we want to access would be some sort of token, and us having that token would let the kernel know that, yes, we were allowed to access this. And an example of this mechanism you can see with file descriptors. When you create a file descriptor by opening a file, at that point the check is done, can you access it? And when you actually read or write or do other operations on the file descriptor, there's no reason to do any more checking against access control list. It's stored with that file descriptor that, yes, you could access the file. So then we moved on to our bigger topic last time, which was virtual machines. We had this layering where we had some real hardware, we had a hypervisor and a host OS, which were running a guest OS, which ran applications as usual. And a lot of how the hypervisor ran the guest OS kind of looked like a normal OS running an application that it would track in some equivalent to a process control block, things like the current registers, the current layout of memory for the guest OS, the current I/O devices the guest OS has access to. It would also need to track some extra information because it was going to provide the guest OS some services that emulated kernel mode for the guest OS. The guest OS at some points is going to think it's in kernel mode, but it's not actually going to be. And to make all that work, we need to track the sort of things that a processor would track for kernel mode. So we need to track whether the guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode or not. We need to track things like the page table pointer and the exception table pointer, things that are set on real hardware, in the hardware for the kernel. Since we're emulating that hardware, we need to track that for the guest OS. And the big strategy that we mentioned for implementing virtual machines was based on this trap and emulate approach, that we'd either hope or make sure that special operations, where by special I mean things that we want to not do the thing they would normally do when we are running code in user mode in our hypervisor, things we wanted to do something else, we'd hope they trigger an exception. This should include things like I/O, updating the things that support kernel mode, like the page table pointer, system calls, and so on. Any sort of operation which is going to need not behave in quite the same way in our virtual machine, we hope triggers an exception. And the exception handler can do what the hardware would have done if the guest OS were running directly on it. So for example, if the guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode, we want to do what would have happened if the guest OS really was in kernel mode on real hardware. So if it thinks it's in kernel mode talking to an I/O device, we want to emulate talking to an I/O device. Maybe we won't talk to quite the same kind of I/O device, like maybe we'll read from the network instead of a keyboard, but we're gonna emulate that operation from the real hardware. If it's setting a page table pointer, we want to update our notion of what its page table pointer is. If it's switching from kernel to user mode, we'll update our information about what mode it's in, and so on. Another case where we have a disagreement between what's going to happen on the real hardware and what the guest OS would expect if it were running directly, not in a virtual machine, is that when something happens in the guest OS that triggers would normally trigger an exception, we want to still trigger an exception in the guest OS, not in the host OS, is going to happen. So we need to, reflect the exception back to the guest OS. For example, if there's a system call that occurs while the guest OS is running, well, on real hardware, that would run the guest OS's system call handler. So we have to, in the hypervisor, run the guest OS's system call handler in that case. Now, a last important thing we needed to implement virtual machines is we need to handle memory. And we have this difficulty that the page table the guest OS set is not what the hardware expects. The hardware expected a mapping from the virtual addresses the guest OS is using to the addresses after we did the guest OS's page table translation and whatever the hypervisor's page table for the guest OS was. So a solution to that is to provide the real hardware with a page table that does that whole translation by building what we called a shadow page table. The name shadow is because we kind of get it by projecting the guest OS's page table through the hypervisor's mapping. And that's what we provide to the hardware. And we mentioned that we could update this on demand, that we could just fill it in as the guest OS accesses things, and we could clear out parts of it in response to TLB flushes. And that's how we could deal with what happens when the guest OS changes its page table. Well, because the guest OS has to deal with flushing the TLB, it's going to have a way to inform the hypervisor when it's trying to inform the real hardware to clear the TLB. A little detail that we had with this scheme was that the page tables don't natively support all the features we kind of want. Like, we wanted to have different pages accessible when the guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode versus when it thinks it's in user mode. But all the controls we have on the real hardware page tables only control what, you know, can be accessed or not. We can't use the kernel mode in the real hardware because the guest OS never runs in kernel mode. So to emulate that, we needed to do this thing where we had two copies of the page tables or something like that. Okay, so for the rest of the day, I'm going to, as I mentioned last time, take your questions on things you want me to review. They can be about things we covered last time or other topics from earlier in the semester. And I'll just take questions, ideally in text chat, because I think it would be too awkward to try to do it via voice. And we'll put them in some order and go through them for the rest of the lecture time. And if you don't have any questions, this will be very quick. Okay, SSDs. Any other topics? Okay. Quiz 11. Which was quiz 11 on? Quiz 11. Quiz 11 was on, okay, right, calculating number of blocks and things like that, mostly. Okay, go to my window. So inode counting, block counting, and hopefully that's the part of quiz 11 you care about, because there's also question 5 and block groups. If you care about those topics, you should ask for them separately if it's not in these. And sockets. And quiz 12, number Q3. It's more helpful to know what the topics are so I can group these together. Okay. So the okay, so let's start with SSDs. So SSDs, sort of the key idea is they're trying to provide the same interface that hard drives provide, but with hardware, very different hardware. So the SSD hardware can read any part, you know, read anything relatively quickly, pretty much no matter what was written before. Read, which is not like, unlike HDDs, head needs to physically move. So in solid state disks, there's nothing physically moving. So, you know, there's not a constraint that you need to read from the same part of the SSD to get good performance. Can write once anything relatively quickly. Can erase to allow rewriting in large chunks only. The SSD's underlying hardware, which is NAND flash. So NAND flash, which is sort of the equivalent of the hard drives, splatters with magnetic signals encoded on them. That's the underlying. So the SSD solution to provide the same interface requires dealing with erasure blocks, which is this issue here. Blocks. Typical by copying data to make space to erase a large chunk. So an erasure block is basically like that you'll have, you know, you have to erase, not sure. So if you, once you've written something, so you've written to block, you can't overwrite it until you erase the whole thing. That's sort of the constraint erasure blocks have. And dealing with erasure blocks. So the problem is that hard drives, I can overwrite one sector, which is like 512 bytes to like 4K at a time efficiently. With SSDs, I can't do that because of erasure blocks. Like the overwriting requires moving the whole thing around. And there's a secondary problem. Also, if you erase blocks too much, they fail. Hard drives, I can overwrite a sector many, many times and it doesn't change how much it fails significantly. So these are both the sort of things that the SSDs need to work around in order to tell the OS, yeah, this is just a hard drive. Because if the OS uses it just like a hard drive and they didn't deal with these issues, the OS is going to assume, okay, I can just keep overwriting that sector. A common example of a sector which would be overwritten would be like a header on a disk. Sometimes it has like summary information, like total bytes used. That keeps getting written. That's going to be real bad because you don't want that to fail. So the solution to hide these problems is by copying data to make space to a large chunk, which implies that The location of a particular sector from the OS's point of view changes in the physical path, in the physical media. So the particular erasure block it's put in will move around as it does this copying to make room to erase a whole big chunk. Does that answer sort of what you were worried about with erasure blocks? Okay, so then let's go through sort of these concerns. So one thing was about inode counting. So inode stores information about a file, and file here includes regular files and directories. Now, and note that this is a file. And by information, I mean like, you know, its size, location of the first few blocks, the file's data, who can access it, modification times, like all that metadata of the file. And this includes regular files and directories. So if you wanted to know how many inodes there are, how many regular files and directories are there? That's the number of inodes. And I guess as a nit case, directory, root directory is a directory. The root directory is a directory, so it needs an inode. So inodes, I usually find the easiest things to count. Blocks, a little harder. So in an inode-based file system, we need to point to the data. And we can't just have the inode point to list all the data blocks because there's not enough room. So the inode has a pointer to the first few data blocks, has pointers to the first few data blocks, which I will call direct pointers. So for example, if an inode has 10 direct pointers and blocks are 2K, then bytes 0 through 20K of the file are found by following the direct pointers in the inode. Now, if we want a bigger file, well, we need more pointers. And one solution could have been that we just add more direct pointers, but that doesn't really scale. So, you know, enough room in direct pointers. I know we use more in direction. We want to be more efficient about how we're using the space in the inode at the cost of more steps to actually find the data. So what we'll do first is a single indirect pointer. So an example, the inode has one indirect pointer, you know, and this will be a running example here. So assume all the examples building each other. It's one indirect pointer. The indirect pointer gives the location of a data block that has 2K of stuff. That stuff is more direct pointers. We couldn't fit them in the inode, so we're gonna put them in another block and point to them. And if direct pointers are 4 byte, if pointers, block pointers are 4 bytes, then there are 512 additional direct pointers. And this means that bytes 20K through 20K plus 512 times 2K which is 1044K will be found by following the indirect pointer in the inode, and then another direct pointer from there. Now, You might say, okay, so now we can handle a megabyte and a little extra file. What if I want a bigger file than that? Well, then, you know, we could add another indirect pointer, but that's not going to scale again. So we'll add a double indirect pointer. Enough. Add a one direct pointer. So if, for example, our inode after the indirect pointer has a double indirect pointer, the double indirect pointer gives the location of a data block that has 2K of stuff. That stuff is more indirect pointers. And it's, in fact, 512 more indirect, is 512 more indirect pointers because the calculation is the same. Each those 512 indirect pointers point to 512 additional direct pointers. So we can find 512 times 512, which is 2, 6, 2, 4 more direct pointers this way. So that means then bytes 144K through 144 plus 262 144 times 2K will be found by following the double indirect pointer. And we can repeat this process as a question. Can we do this for triple or quadruple? Yes, we absolutely can. So repeat this, we can add triple or quadruple, etc., if the size we can support isn't big enough yet. So something with which in block counting, which seems to confuse people, is, wait a moment, like what happens if I don't need all of these pointers? So let's think of an example. Let's say we have a file that is 180K file. So what we're gonna do first is bytes 0 through 20K of this file are going to use the direct pointers. Bytes 20K through 44K are going to use indirect pointer and fill the extra direct pointers that points to. So if we, let's do a running total here. So after byte 0 through 20K, we have 10 blocks of data. And here we have 512 more blocks of data plus one block of pointers, the one pointed to by the indirect pointer in the inode. Bytes 144K through 1080K are going to use the double indirect pointer, but they only need the first indirect pointer that points to. Like, it's still a double indirect pointer, so even though we only need a few blocks here, you know, we're gonna do that. And that first indirect pointer is going to only need two 18 direct pointers filled. So we'll have a block, so we'll have 18 blocks of data plus one block that the double indirect pointer points to, filled with indirect pointers. filled with indirect pointers, but only the first one is used because we don't have enough data in the file to require more, plus one block pointed to by the first indirect pointer that the double indirect pointer in the block pointed to by the double indirect pointer. And this has space for 512 direct pointers, but only 18 of them are used. So if we wanted to figure out how many blocks this requires, we have 10 plus 512. It's 512 plus 18 blocks of data, plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 blocks of pointers. Of pointers not all filled. Okay. And realizing that we have these cases where, oh, wait, we don't need all of the blocks is where people seem to get most confused in these block counting, figuring out these block how many blocks are actually used. Okay, so questions about this. So I suppose I could go over the quiz questions on this, but I'm not sure like what part of them would be super useful. I'll take more specific things about things from the quiz that are confusing given this explanation so far. So we have extents. So sort of based on the observation here is that you might say, gosh, we have three blocks of data that we're storing. This here is 6K of extra stuff to store the file. So that's actually pretty high. Can we do better than that? Since the idea is that we, instead of storing a list of blocks, we store a range of blocks or a list of ranges of blocks. The range of blocks is called an extent. So this is something we store instead of block pointers, typically a good idea for a very large files, but we have a challenge. We need to allocate contiguous blocks, meaning consecutive, I probably use rather, blocks to make this useful. So for our 1080K file, like example for 1080K file above, could store if we found 2 equals 540 data blocks next to each other of it that were free and next to each other, we could store one extent, probably in the inode, to point to the file's data. The challenge is that we need to be able to do that. If we can't, this is not going to help us so much. Maybe we can store a list of these extents, but you know, in the extreme, that's going to get worse than just storing all the block numbers. But hopefully, usually, we can just get this, you know, more compact way. So I know I haven't gone through everything that was in. I haven't gone through the specific quiz questions. I'm hoping that this example here gives people enough to figure out things that we don't have specific questions. I can go back onto them, or if there's something I'm missing that's in the quiz question, let me know. If not, I'll move on, at least for now, to sockets, first of all. So sockets, the idea is that our two-way, you know, have the interface of two-way pipes to access the network, i.e. communicate between machines. You mentioned that they could also just be communicate locally, but the big purpose is communicating between machines. And so once set up, the way you read on one end, write on the other, and write on one end, and read on the other, or vice versa. So the setup process is where, you know, they're significantly different, and the setup process is going to be different on the client and the server end. So the client end, first we do socket to get a file descriptor. Then we make this call to, then our typical pattern that we mentioned. You might see this slightly different if you know more about sockets. You also might realize that this is more complicated. There's some ways we're not going to talk about in this class if you know about real sockets. But the basic procedure is that you, once it's set up, you're going to write on one end, read on the other. And the setup is first you call socket to get a file descriptor. Then you call something like get outer info to translate a host name plus service name, you know, HTTP, like virginia.edu and HTTP into a IP address plus port number, which I'll call a socket address, the combination of these two things. And then you call connect to associate your prior file descriptor with that remote address, remote socket address. And this is, that's the process in the client. On the server end, you call socket to get a file descriptor, which won't be the one we use to talk to the client. We'll see that later. We call get outer info to translate a host name plus service name into a socket address again. Then we call bind to associate our, we'll call the server socket file descriptor, that address. Then we call listen to tell the OS, yes, I expect someone else to connect to me. And then we call accept to get a new file descriptor that is set up to talk to a particular client. And we can call accept multiple times to talk to multiple clients. And we have separate file descriptors for each one, you know, descriptors for each client, so there's no confusion about, you know, no confusion about who we're writing to. That's the socket interface. So and this accept is done with the server socket is the one from the server's called the socket and it's using server socket file descriptor. And it's passed to accept to get the new file descriptor. Does that answer your question? So then a question about stateful versus stateless. So servers, we'll say, and this we were specifically thinking about the client server model when we talked about this concept, don't remember things about their clients between requests. So example for a file server doesn't know or care what the clients have open right now. Open just cares about getting the data, etc., you know, getting the data, writing the data, when the client wants to read, write, or do some other operation. Another example is a web server. You know, if it's just serving clients, you know, if it's just sending web pages, shouldn't care what web pages the client requested before or after. Before, after. So a notion is that each request stands alone. That you don't, when you're looking at what the server is doing at any time, you can just look at what did the last request say. You don't need any other state. Stateful servers need to remember things between requests. So an example is SSH. You know, needs to make sure the thing you type now, thing you type, the command you type now, the one you type later, go to the same shell session. And needs to remember what user you logged in as in this session. So, and the session, you know, each session sort of has multiple requests that are connected to each other. We think of how SSHing into a server works. And sort of like, why would we want stateful versus stateless? So stateful, there are things we can do that we can't do without. Like, you can't do something like SSH very nicely without stateful servers. Stateless servers have the advantage of, you know, less work for the server or client when dealing with server or client crashing. If the client crashes, well, the server doesn't need to remember anything about what the client was doing. If the server crashes, the client doesn't need to worry that the server forgot something. We think of SSH. If the server crashes, well, you need to start over. If the client crashes, well, the server can't like resume that easily unless you have a bunch of extra simpletons. Does this cover what people were wondering about with stateful versus stateless? So then let's go to quiz 12, question 3. Okay, so the question was, which of the following were possible? Let's see if I can do copy paste. I think the chances are probably low, but we'll try. Could have been worse. Oh, I probably have these marked wrong. Do I? No. That is a yes. Okay. I have the percentages wrong. That's why I was confused. Yes. Yes. Okay, so this was asking about RPC with a fail stop model. So let's go through this first one here. Sending from the client an RPC that changes something on the server appears to fail on the client. How this can happen is the network cable is unplugged after the server gets the request, but before it can send an acknowledgement. That's how that can happen. So remember that in order to do this, so there's some setup in the problem where it says it sends an acknowledgement and keeps trying until a certain amount of time has passed. There's like nothing guaranteeing that it, you know, yes, the server retries sending this, but the network can be more patient than the server, like, about how long it's going to take to restore. So then sending from client that fails to reach the server, it appears to work on the client. This can't happen because in the setup for the question, client assumes RPCs fail unless there's an acknowledgement. So the scheme we've chosen, you know, risks this problem that the client can think it failed, but it really didn't, at the expense, in order to prevent it from being the case that the client thinks it worked and it didn't. Which is usually the choice you want to make. Usually you prefer that things sometimes work when you think they don't than the other way around. And this can happen. The same way. It's actually a duplicate question, just asked in a different way. You unplug the network cable. Oh, and that is RPC. Yes. So here we have the, here this is the symplug after the client gets the return value, but before the client acknowledges getting the return value. Okay, is that, people think, any issues with my explanations of these answers? And I guess this appear to be processed. This is, in retrospect, this was a poor choice because I wasn't clear whether process correctly included sending the return value back. I'm assuming not. That the processing is what we need to do to actually run it on the server, not to send back the result. And kind of the reason I'd assume that is because you kind of expect that once the server returns, it think it's done. Anyways, but like maybe I should reconsider that. Okay, then we have last quiz, question 4 and 5. So for both of these questions, we have this scenario. And I'm going to like write down the steps sort of more systematically. Letter these steps because that will be useful later. Okay, and the question is, what involves exceptions on the host machine and the guest machine. So system call, you know, guest program is executing the same code it would if it ran, same code it does outside of VM, which implies that there is a system call instruction in it, which implies a exception for a system call on the real hardware. Yes, this is going to need to turn into an emulated system call, but it's going to be a real system call exception. Real hardware, and the hypervisor needs to run the guest OS's system call handler, because that's what would have happened on the real hardware. I'll get to future questions later. We'll have time. Don't worry. So here, the guest OS needs to use an instruction to change what program is running and to change to user mode. Change what program is running, and if you think about that, this is change the page table and to change to user mode. Both of these can't be done by code running in user mode, which implies that they'll result in a protection fault, and the hypervisor will emulate them and actually update hypervisor data structures. So e.g., the hypervisor is tracking what the guest OS thinks its page table pointer is separately from the real page table pointer, because they need to be different. Okay. So then we have the hypervisor detects keyboard input. This means that on the real hardware, an I/O device probably caused an interrupt to get the hypervisor to run. And know that there's keyboard input. But we haven't done anything to let the guest know there's keyboard input, so there won't be an exception in the guest OS. But not yet visible to guest OS, so no exception in guest OS. And similarly up here, for B, this is not visible in guest OS. You know, guest OS thinks the operation just works normally. So there's no exception in the guest OS, from the guest OS's point of view. And here, now there's an exception in the guest OS because we emulated one. This guest OS reads a register from the keyboard controller. We aren't going to allow the guest OS to access the keyboard controller directly. So this implies there's going to be a protection fault on the real hardware. And the hypervisor will emulate accessing the keyboard controller. And then the guest OS switches to the original program. This is same as B. Okay, so questions about sort of my reasoning about what types of exceptions we have at each of these steps. So then we have, in that case, there's someone asking quiz 13Q2. So quiz 13 was saying that we have an NFS v2 server, which is stateless. And without caching, we read 1024K and 128K chunks. So open file and read. Our steps we need here, our client steps, are lookup to get ID of file, read 8 times, once for each chunk. So we have to look up because we need the ID of the file for future RPC calls, like read. Also, because we need to tell the program whether or not the open can succeed. The open fails, e.g. no such file. Read 8 times, can't do less because we don't cache anything between reads. The program does. And so that's where I got the count. So you're asking why you didn't have an extra one. So note that we're getting an idea of a file. This is not a file descriptor. This is an identifier for the file that, the ID, D, is something like inode number of the file. The server doesn't need to know when we're done with the ID. So there's not any more operations which are required, even if we're closing the file or something like that. And we don't need to write anything back. That's it. Yeah, so there isn't really an open, there's a lookup. The lookup, part of what open does is check if the file is still there, and lookup is a way of doing that. And that is something they need to do. So the question is, the client cannot have the file D for the directory it's in. Would that be an extra lookup? Yes, and potentially multiple extra lookups if we need to get the directory's in, and so on. Other questions of any sort? Are we finishing early? So, question is, does the server use something like file descriptors on its end and store them with an associated ID or something like that is for files? So, in the scheme we talked about, the ID is something like the inode number. So within the file system, you can find it kind of like how you went from probably in your FAT assignment from a cluster number to a file. So it's that kind of information. It's very common for NFS servers to be implemented on Unix-like systems in the kernel, which means that you don't need to actually use an open system call. You can just access the file system more directly, which makes that more convenient. If you don't do that, then you need to do something where you somehow go from file IDs and translate that to system calls, which means you need to do some fancy file descriptor tracking. But that is not actually the most common way NFS servers work. Usually they're part of the kernel. to allow you to use things like I/O numbers instead of file descriptors. And I guess, as we mentioned when we talk about it, this is usually something like this. If a server wanted to store some other sort of information in the ID, it can do that if it has a very different way of implementing things. So, like, if a server couldn't use I/O numbers, you could have, like, an actual database and have the IDs be entries in that database. Other questions? Hopefully that answers your question. Question for B, which operation causes a protection fault? Probably both of them. So changing, and you're saying, changing, probably a protection fault for each of these operations. So each of those operations is probably a protection fault. And this has changed the guest page table, is what the guest OS is trying to do. That's going to have to end up changing the shadow page table, but the guest OS isn't trying to do that. So the guest page table will end up changing. Guest PT will end up changing the shadow page table. Shadow page table, but the guest OS doesn't know about the shadow page table. Does that answer your question? Yeah, and I guess subtly I made an assumption that keyboard input causes an interrupt here. And yeah, I kind of glossed over that this is really two operations probably, but kind of as a shorthand in this question. Okay, other follow-up here, things to... Okay, so if there's not more questions, I'll just call it here. And, okay. How is what we've covered in this class different from modern operating systems? So, operating systems move very slowly. Surprisingly slowly. So, for example, journaling file systems, probably in academia, date back to early 90s. And it probably wasn't until, Windows 2000 that it was the default on consumer Windows systems. Maybe probably Windows Vista until it was the default in consumer Windows systems. So 15 years for an obviously good idea. And other things like that are surprisingly slow to get it. So it's not as different as you might suspect for that reason. Now, there are a bunch of things we didn't talk about in much detail that are pretty important in modern OSs. Like, we didn't talk about multi-core very much, and that changes a lot of the design of OSs. We talked about a way of implementing virtual machines, but We can talk about what hardware support for that looks like, which is these days much more important. See other topics. But for the most part, it's kind of a subset of what OSs do. We just kind of maybe miss some more exotic features, that more recent features. And more recent features on modern OSs is often something which was in the literature like 20 years ago. Or things like OSs is like that. So another more concrete example is like sort of file syncing in the style of Dropbox was like research papers in the 90s. But it took that long. So is the schedule for the final set like this? The schedule is set. It's as on the webpage, so like an hour before scheduled file time, due an hour after that. The plan is I give you a final and a text document template to write your answers. You upload that text document to Kaitos. I hope to have it be a similar length to finals from prior semesters. I anticipate the sort of take-home format will change the type of questions I ask a bit, but probably a similar type set of topics. Though we covered a little less of most topics this semester after the break, because apparently I go slower when doing online lectures. And the question, how long would it take to write a modern operating system from scratch? So I guess one thing which is maybe different from modern operating systems is that we talked about Unix-style operating system designs. And this is probably dominant in the consumer space. There are other types of operating system designs which you're more likely to see in a recently written OS. So the big thing is that we've talked about it in some prior semesters. You can see a lecture on microkernels. So these sort of big other design are designs which are microkernel based. That's sort of one other big other design. And those are easier to write and start writing, easier to get working, and sort of more likely what people would do from scratch. And many of those, like the core parts of them, are very small, like 3,000-4,000 lines. They're probably maybe smaller than that. And I guess I would say, like, we're talking about modern operating systems, there's also the sort of the universe of research operating systems, which are many of which have very different designs. So people do write those still write microkernels, generally not alone, but there are functional research OSs out there which are probably written by teams of like 4 to 5 people. And like by functional, I mean like can run most programs that run on Linux. Like including things like threading support and networking support and all that. And I guess we didn't talk about, if you're thinking about operating systems research, we didn't talk about sort of different OS designs much this semester. And there are, if people are thinking of writing new OSs, usually they have an idea in mind where they, maybe don't want to use the Unix design. Because it's, it has some things which aren't so nice. The biggest thing is that everything's in the kernel, and that's actually kind of usually considered bad. Any other things before I finish up? Okay, so thanks for good semester. I still have office hours later this week, and so on. If you want to schedule a time to talk to me, you should email me about that. Because I have meetings soon.